Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello.
Justin Robert Young.
Yo, folks. Who got to melt things with lasers this weekend?
Yeah, not that's a common way people introduce things and just kick it off. I didn't melt anything with lasers either.
Well, technically, I was actually welding asteroid analogs with the laser because I may have been, you know, hanging out with the people working on the technology behind Project Starshot, you know, where they want to use lasers to propel things to the next star system. And one of the things they're using too is lasers to deflect asteroids and to, you know, do that kind of thing. And they're showing me their test model. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm more into like, let's take asteroids and build giant space habitats. Could you actually weld an asteroid with these things? And one of the researchers is like, yeah. Jonathan says like, yeah, let's try it. And 10 minutes later, we've all got our super thick laser goggles on and a high energy laser melting pieces of rock together. So,
Wait a minute. You're telling me that not only did you get to see this in action, it was based on a experiment that you flippantly just kind of threw out there to the space laser people?
I was throwing so many dumb ideas out there at them. They were kind of like, all right, we should just probably do one thing to make them happy. So
give the baby his bottle. Let's melt an asteroid.
So I'm gonna back up with a story that's going to go lead into this, all right?
Okay.
There are these things called FRBs, fast radio bursts. Fast radio bursts are very mysterious flashes of energy that we spot in the sky that we're not quite sure what they are. Because the problem is, if you look at the amount of energy that they have when it's called brightness temperature, it's 10 to the 37 degrees. It's not so much a matter of, you know, like how hot it really is, but the amount of energy coming from something, right? And the problem is that like that's beyond anything that we can think of in cosmology. Pulsars, everything. It's just super, super, super intense. They sweep by, they flash. Maybe you see one again, but there's no real regular schedule to them. We're not, and they come from what appears to be outside our galaxy. So
wow.
It's one of those like space is really scary and weird mysteries because we don't know, right? So some researchers have proposed, aha, let's come up with something because in this day and age, nothing's too crazy or out there. What if you were to build a system that was going to like reflect sunlight or an energy system that was going to do a directed beam energy system and use it to move a spacecraft? Not unlike what we've talked about before, the work of Project Starshot, which was based upon the UC Santa Barbara professor Phil Lubin's work on using phased array lasers to propel things at very high speeds. And I have some stuff that I have some interesting little details about that too, which hasn't been disclosed. Anyhow.
Hold on. Just pretend I know I get all of everything you just said, but just, you know, poor Justin may not be caught up.
I'll tell you what, man, I'm dumber than a box of rocks set in slow motion.
So like, real quick,
dumb this one down for Justin.
Project Starshot, to begin with, is a method of propulsion that uses lasers from Earth to propel something forward, right?
So what it was is there's a researcher, Dr. Phil Lubin at UC Santa Barbara, who's worked on NASA projects, and he proposed about 3 or 4 years ago, said, you know, lasers have evolved to the point where we can make a very precise beam much further out than we could before. So if you aim that beam at, let's say, a 1 meter wide piece of reflective, like a mirror, because you need to have 100% reflectivity, the photons hitting that would impart kinetic energy and move it. And if you built a big enough array, like a 100 gigawatt array, it could put something to 30% the speed of light.
Got it.
Okay. So Project Starshot was Yuri Milner, who's a Russian billionaire, and some other people said, hey, we love this. Let's do this. And it kind of became this big initiative. It's based on Phil's work, but it's, they'll, you know, you hear like, oh, Stephen Hawking's idea. Stephen Hawking's just a name they put on the letterhead because, you know, he's awesome. But anyhow, Project Starshot's this initiative to try to make that happen. But any event, the idea is that if you use a bunch of lasers, reflect them off of a mirror, those little photons hitting the mirror and bouncing off will push that forward.
Okay. So and then separate vector, the other piece of the puzzle is we're seeing these fast radio bursts that are super intense from very, very far away. And am I hearing you right that you're conjecturing, like, you know, what if those are like bleed over from another craft being propelled around?
I'm not, but Lieb and Lingam, the researchers who've worked on this proposal, they've said, hey, what if it's something like that? What if it's like something outside of our galaxy where some aliens are using some sort of laser lighthouse thing to propel their rockets and push them further out there?
That would be intense. So, and I guess the reason that would make sense is because, like, a gamma ray burst that happens when a star goes supernova, like, that's a lot of energy in all directions at once. Mm-hmm. These fast radio bursts, these are more energy than we would
way
see?
Way more. Way, way, way more. But like, magnitudes of more energy.
Which would not make sense if it was going in all directions, but might correct. Make sense if it just happened, you know, just like a laser light, like to get a single light bulb so bright it's blinding requires a lot more energy than to run a laser and just happen to zip it past your eye, that enough to flash is it? That's
which we would not recommend here on Weird Things, by the way.
Right, no, right, right. But you know what? Maybe that's what it is. Maybe they're aliens trying to harass the planet Earth, just messing with people. It's a space toddler out there with a laser, just going.
So the idea is that every now and then it just maybe they're not sending things, but I'll tell you what's kind of cool. So by the way, this is. For our audio listeners, I'm showing a picture of just how bright, and that's it's like an infrared laser that we're looking at right there that's melting rock and then some melty rock afterwards.
Dude, that looks awesome.
So the weld basically was like obsidian. Anyhow, so the researchers said with this energy, this much power going into it, they calculated the size of this at 1 million tons, roughly the weight of 20 large cruise ships.
Is what it would take to make what?
That's the size of the spacecraft heading towards us right now, Brian, to take us over and steal our women and our Skittles.
How big? And our Skittles?
All right, now you've gone too far.
Yeah. Ask him if they have the power to make the green ones lime again.
Yeah, the size of 20 cruise ships.
20 cruise ships. Man, that's yeah.
We live in an interesting age now where you can write there is, given that we find that life, the ingredients for life are abundant in the universe, we're finding that planets are just filled with planets. It's everywhere you look. Planets are boring now. Oh, we discovered a new planet. Oh, ooh, special, great. Oh, it could be Earth, could inhabit life. So what? That happens every week now. It feels like that, right?
Yeah.
We live in an exciting age. So now what if you want to start saying, like, well, maybe aliens, you're not going to be laughed out of academia. You're not going to be laughed away as researchers. These are Harvard, you know, these are Harvard researchers. These are people who are, you know, serious academics are saying, hey, let's consider this. This is published in the Astrophysical Journal of Letters, right? So it's like, it's not this fringe sort of weekly world news thing. And they're not saying it's proof. They're saying, hey, let us consider this idea because we have a phenomenon with no good natural explanation. Maybe it is. And we're hearing more and more the idea of like Tabby Star, where they're talking about the idea of maybe it's an alien megastructure because we don't know what else is going on there.
Well, and it's tempting to just make aliens the catch-all, deus ex machina of all solutions. But what I like about that kind of thinking is, you know, in the 1970s, it's like we haven't heard anything that we understand. Therefore, there's no one out there. Whereas now it seems like the mentality is more it's very likely that there are plenty of people out there. We're just too dumb to understand what we're supposed to be looking for. And then which is a much more growth mindset than the other.
Or they're just nobody's talking. You know, I mean, because part of what SETI is based upon is that there could be thousands of civilizations out there, millions of civilizations. Maybe a couple of them are actually like at the same window we're around and actually trying to talk to us because everybody else is like, I don't really want company. I'm just going to stay home tonight, you know? It's going to be awkward.
And when we do find the aliens, they're all wearing their sweatpants. They got a tub of ice cream.
Hey,
their hair's pulled up.
Yeah. What are you guys into right now? Oh, the selfie pictures and social media stuff. Yeah, I remember that. That was adorable. All right. Anyhow, I'm going to go. Help yourself.
Anyway, you guys, well, I'll see you later. Right. Okay. Bye.
Yeah. Wait. You know, it's like, you in school, like you have like the really boring kid that wants to hang out.
Yeah. That's us. Like,
yeah, that's pretty much who we are. That's
so
a good point.
With Project Starshot, is there any way to decelerate?
I was able to, courtesy to some of the researchers and students who are working on the actual, they're not project, like projects are involved, but that's an initiative. It's a bigger sort of initiative that's started, but hasn't actually done anything yet. But these people are actually doing research there, research over at UC Santa Barbara. And they've got some first rate research going on there in a lot of different areas, photonics, et cetera, and all that. So Jonathan Majan, I can pronounce his name right. He was the one kind of guiding me around along with some other people who are working there, including the guy who – Nick, who's the guy who's actually making these wafer sats and stuff, which I'll talk about in a second. So I'm like, you know, I'm pestering them with all of my little idiotic questions and stuff about what about this? What about this? Can they do this? What about this and stuff? And frequently Jonathan's having to text Professor Lubin to ask my stupid questions because he's like, let me ask. And deceleration is a big problem because you're moving at 30% the speed of light, right? You're moving 30. You're using this big, humongous array that takes, you know, 100 gigawatts of energy to propel you, and you're heading towards another star system. How would you slow down? You need an equal amount, roughly an equal amount of energy to slow you down, which is the challenge, right? So I threw out a number of suggestions, you know, because I know they're just waiting for me to, like, you know.
Exactly. We're just waiting for somebody on the tour to just kind of solve this problem here.
It's like 20, the size of 20 cruise ships, we need a former cruise ship magician to ask questions.
I have the problem solved. I would say at 2 points that my questions were referred, and then response was, yes, Professor Lubin actually has a paper he's working on using describing that method. So
nice.
They weren't the dumbest things in the world yet.
Can he also use the invisible deck? I don't think so.
Probably not. So that's one of the problems. And there, you know, a lot of different I don't want to tell anything out of school as far as, like, you know, like what, because some of the stuff I said, like, oh yeah, no, that's going to be, you know, doing a paper on that kind of thing. But you could try to find other ways to try to get energy from there. Like, how would you, if you could use, you know, how maybe ways in which you could try to build an array there remotely to capture solar power, you know, would have to be humongous and very, very large. One of the things that I sent them some papers on, which is interesting, is using electrodynamic tethers, which are pieces of wire that when they pass through magnetic fields, they generate energy. And, you know, initially I'm like, well, you know, if you're going past, you know, a gas giant or a star at 30% the speed of light, there's generate a lot of energy, but very briefly. But turns out I found a paper that talked about there is actually a interstellar magnetic field between, like, our star system, our sun, and several light years across from when an exploding star created this sort of gaseous sort of expansion, and we're in sort of a bubble with a different sort of density than other areas of the Milky Way. And in there's a magnetic field, and that actually may be an ambient way in which you could, like, have a tether hanging and actually produce some sort of energy, right? So there's a lot of different interesting ideas, and they're doing cool stuff. They're also working on cosmic background radiation. They have a telescope they're going to be putting in Greenland to be able to detect, like, to kind of develop sort of a map of, like, near-term stuff so you can get better resolution for what's out there. They have projects Deep Star, or they have Deep In, and they have another project which is D-Star, which is using lasers to deflect asteroids. And they showed me some really cool video of a piece of rock on, like, a little torsion balance or a pendulum, and the laser was getting it to spin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So the idea, is just that we have lasers and asteroids headed to planet Earth. You zap the side of it so that it flares up and mass and energy is released and it propulses it out of the way.
Yeah, and one of the cool things too is that that what can work too is that Jonathan showed me that if you impart it with a bit of spin, and then if you actually go to their website, you'll see this really cool graph. which shows you that if you have this rock and you start and spinning and you start heating up the middle of it, what'll happen is that its directional path isn't just going to be right away from where you're hitting it, is that it's going to keep sort of moving. You can sort of, you can do a lot of steering with it basically, which is pretty sweet.
Very
cool. So, anyhow, the thing that I was asking was, I was asking about like, what are the limits for, you know, this velocity, how fast could you propel something? Cause I'm like, well, what if you put laser systems at a Lagrange point and we accelerated more, blah, blah, blah. And the answer back from Dr. Lubin was your limit, your upper limit is the speed of light.
Wow. Wow.
And what's exciting about this is this method uses conventional technology. This is not an Alcubierre drive with, you know, we put unicorn tears inside here and all of a sudden we get warp drive. This is not, oh, we need to figure out how to build fusion so we can have a fusion rocket. This is, you get a couple $1 billion or a few $100 billion and we start building arrays. It is everything you need exists technology right now. It's an engineering problem. It's not a science problem. I mean, it's science, but it's not a physics problem. It doesn't mean we have to have prove some theory is true or whatever. It's an engineering and economics problem, so which means
I would imagine that when you get going, you know, 30%, 50% the speed of light, you know, space debris would be a bit of an issue. I mean, do we know for sure that all that space is empty space?
No, we don't. And so that's one of the challenges they have to figure out is part of what they're doing is they're trying to reduce the size of the spacecraft itself to an extremely small thing. They want to put the entire probe onto, you know, a little chip that's 7 microns across, just ridiculously small, right? They want to try to reduce the size of that to an extremely small thing and then redundancy. And so what you would do is maybe you would send it edge on. The thing would start to propel and so it would have the thinnest edge there. And you'd be sending – you accelerate this thing for 3 minutes, right? Like 3 minutes and you're at 30% the velocity speed of light, right?
Oh, wow.
Or 30 or 20 minutes, right? That's how long the laser's on. So you could send – if you're doing – you know, you could be sending tens of thousands of these probes and hope that not all of them get hit. And you could do maybe send one probe ahead, another one right behind it and whatever and use deflection. There's a lot of different, you know, we just need to start sending, building these things.
And really the only thing that is stopping us is money and physically building them, right? And,
yeah.
And putting them into space.
We have, and Dr. Lubin's got papers that talk about how to, there are a lot of ideas on how to slow things down. This is a technology that can scale if you have more energy and, you know, more energy than we can produce right now, but not to say not more than 20 or 30 years from now. You know, right now with places like SpaceX building gigafactories and our energy requirements have been pretty just logarithmic increasing. But if we started to say, let's really try to figure out how to produce more energy, the energy problem, these things could be solved. We could be an interstellar civilization within the next several decades, literally sending probes and starting to put satellites and stuff around other stars. And like I said, the speed limit isn't 30%, which was the thing that was in the paper that he did for the NASA paper. Mm-hmm. Speed limit is speed of light. You know, so we could be sending stuff to Proxima B. We could get it there in 4 years, within our lifetimes. Wow. We could be getting stuff there.
That's extraordinary. That would be a thing. So how was it that you came to be hanging out with these guys?
I have a friend that's really active in the space community who introduced me to another person who's connected to that. And then I ended up, it started with me going on a tour of XPRIZE. And then SpaceX with some of the people working on this and just conversation. And I didn't know I was going to be on the tour with them. And then they found out I was like a fanboy of their work. I knew exactly what they're doing, knew the papers and stuff, which was sort of surprising for them, you know, like. And then, you know, just got to talking and then brought a group of them to the Magic Castle and just, you know, hung out and got along, just had a lot of fun talking about this stuff because, you know, I'm not in the lab working in the way they are. I'm just an outsider who follows this stuff and a lot of related stuff. So I'm asking interesting but dumb questions. So
yeah,
interestingly stupid
yeah,
questions.
Yeah,
you know, like a bottle rocket without the stem. you know, it might hit something interesting, but it'll be curious.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, that's not at all how that works, you know, but yeah. So.
I'll tell you what, everybody, you can support how this show works if you go ahead and support us at patreon.com/nightattack. At least I didn't say 1-900-WRESTLING. Patreon.com/weirdthings. That is where you support this show. We depend on you guys to do this every single week. We greatly appreciate you. And right now, 404 patrons, you can be the one that makes sure that these patrons are found and indeed are not an error 404. Thank you to everybody who does it. And we are very, very excited to continue rocking and rolling with this show.
It is super, super appreciated, guys and girls and cis goblins, that your support for what we're able to do here. It does mean a lot to us. It does. It is encouraging is to know that there are people who care about this and wanted to keep going and help support gas money to go to UC Santa Barbara, which I'll be going back there this week for a project. I got a we had a little topic thingy came in. There were two topics. Brian sent in. You sent anything about that? One of the developers of lithium ion batteries that says he's got a new battery technology. There is a very funny like Elon Muskism when people ask him about new battery technologies, and he has mm-hmm. to sort of think. Well, we have a chart where we keep track of them, you know, because every week somebody says this, but when it leaves the lab, you know, that's when we're interested in it. But it's a very interesting thing because it keeps coming back to, like with battery technology, is we've had when we talk about lithium ion, we tend to think that lithium ion kind of batteries are all sort of the same. But lithium just literally means that, you know, that's just one aspect to it. And kind of most batteries involve ions in some sort of aspect. But the chemistries of these have been changing dramatically. You think about, you know, what the density of what the power you got out of a battery today versus what you got out 10 years ago has increased a lot. But it's not as much as the rate we see with microprocessors. So,
yeah.
But it's a very interesting thing. So this battery I'm looking at says it's going to have like maybe 3 times the density of today's batteries.
Yeah, specifically and keep in mind, this comes from the lab of this is at the University of Texas. This mm-hmm. is from the guy who created the original lithium ion batteries. His team is now 94 years old, and his team basically identified, like, one of the problems with batteries is that they use liquids as the electrolyte, as the conductive, the ways that the ions go from one anode to the anode diode. I don't know how all that works, but the core of this idea is that they've got glass electrolytes. So instead of mm-hmm. instead of two metals being suspended in a liquid, which, you know, if it ruptures and apparently over time there's, you know, microfractures that increase the possibility of combustion. But by having a glass-based – an anode and a cathode, that's what it is. Yeah, a diode. But by having a glass electrolyte as the suspension medium, you have basically a single solid state battery that they're claiming could be 3 times as powerful and charge much, much quicker and be much more secure and safer. But we've talked a lot on the show before about how, you know, it's the problem with wind and solar and all that is not with our ability to capture energy from them. It's the fact that we just don't have a storage medium that works long term.
We ain't got a big enough bucket.
That's right.
Just spilling all over the place.
So it's we're going to see something, because like they've got like there's aluminum air batteries is another approach to try to solve this problem and it's, you know, we're going through, you know, where I was over at UC Santa Barbara. They've got one of the things, they're one of the leading centers in the world, like one of two, for trying to figure out how to integrate photonics on semiconductors. So if you want to get into like doing things with lasers and light and eventually light computing, using light to do computations and stuff, and then you're still working with silicon, and silicon is not really a good conductor of light, you got to integrate those things there. But talking to some of the people there, you know, as I went to some of the other labs, and literally a guy pulls a case out, you know, and like shows me like the small box the size of a paperback book. It's like, yeah, it's a $60,000 laser I just got.
Wow.
And it's got like, and you understand like this, it looks like you're like, it looks like this box. It's like, where's the grip? You know, where's the stun setting? And it's got two, it's got like looks like a serial port there. And it's got these two like valves on the end, like two entrance, like a, two holes in it. That's for the water pump to keep the thing from frying. But long story short is that there's a problem. It's like there's you can have a lot of great ideas in these labs they talk about, but it's like trying to figure out how to get that and make it scale for manufacturing. How do you actually figure out how do you make this thing in bulk? And you could have the best idea in the world, but it's like, you know, getting that cost down to compete with conventional methods can be a challenge, but we're going to get there. And it may be this, you know, maybe this. I mean, this guy probably knows about batteries.
I think he's probably got a fairly good idea. You know,
cynically, is it because he's getting old and he's like, ah, it's a remote control battery. I got to go into the kitchen and get a new one. What if?
Yeah, well, and of course, this is he's the leader of the research team, but you know, it's not just.
Not everyone on his research team is 94 years old, right?
Exactly. You know? Although that would be great if his entire team was also 94 years old. And it turns out that this is just a press release from a nursing home.
And it's his bridge already group. Making the movie.
They're just everyone's just remembering World War II and, you know, just hanging out talking about batteries.
So, gentlemen, speaking of longevity and stuff, how would you like it if I had you guys frozen and then revived you later? We all up with that?
Man, you know, that's, you know, that really brings the cost to bear for time travel, right? Because you're definitely just out of the mix for a while there.
Well, and also in this scenario, how safe are we assuming this is? Is there any risk?
I mean, Brian, getting into an Uber has risk.
Okay. All right.
That's why they banned him in Austin.
That's right. They're too risky.
Brian, risk. I like the fact with you, I'm like, well, everything has risk. And you almost just flipped the bit. You're like, oh, no, that's a true point. So I'm okay.
Well, my point is, I just don't know. Yes, I would be interested, but but not today. Like, there's nobody who has any technology that is remotely safe enough to do it today. So I don't know if this is in a different scenario where it is possible or what. Like, I mean, granted, I want to live as long as possible just because, you know, we're all linking a chain in this amazing story of humanity. And I want to know as close to the end as I can get. And if that means, you know, later on when, you know, peace out, yeah, I'll freeze. Why?
Brian just wants to just run through the movie theater of life and take a peek into all the other movies and see how they end, but not sit down and watch them.
That's accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. So the problem is
guilty as charged, officer.
The problem is that if we're pretty good at like freezing stuff now. We can flash freeze tissue, organs, things like that. We can flash freeze. I'm like, good, it's frozen, it's good, looks good, stable. All right, put it on ice, save it for later. Problem is when you want to defrost it. Once you start to defrost, little ice crystals start to form. They start to burst and make it taste terrible or make it really bad for trying to transplant this organ or whatever. That's been one of the biggest problems in trying to like do cryopreservation. Well, some researchers say they've solved this problem or maybe onto the solution for this problem. And they have a new method that they say that they can use to defrost tissue, even large tissue samples, and it doesn't produce the ice crystals. It doesn't damage. They say they can do this and defrost it without doing this, and we get the coolest phrase of the day, nano warming.
Okay, so real quick, the ice crystals form during the thawing process. I did not know that. I thought the freezing was when we ran into trouble, but I guess if you flash freeze it fast enough, it's kind of like super cooled, basically.
Correct. You bypass that, but the problem is as you're cooling it back down, ice crystals can form and rupture, right?
Warming it back up, yeah.
You know, as you're doing that temperature variation, whatever, so they start to form. So they have a thing called nano warming, where basically they put nanoparticles inside of the medium, and then they use, I assume, you know, an electrical field to then heat it up. The researchers mixed silica-coated iron oxide nanoparticles into a solution and generated uniform heat by applying an external – there we go, an external magnetic field. And so basically they're able to sort of just, you know, heat it up from the inside.
Oh, wow. So I guess like so it's not so much the warming itself, but the unevenness and the speed of the warming?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's exactly it.
That is awesome.
So they were able to – they used a combination of human and pig samples up to 50 milliliters, which 50 milliliters I think is about the size of almost 2 ounces, or 50 milliliters is about a quarter cup.
That's tremendous. Now, because you realize there's so many different things that means, not just for, you know, freezing heads of people dying and whatever, but – like this means theoretically an organ bank could be a true bank, like just mm-hmm. you know, everybody puts their organs up and then you separate them all and then they sit on the shelf for 20 years and then finally the right match for the right person at the right time happens and
that's
then they're able
exactly
to get
the goal. That is precisely what their justification for this is. They talk about something about 20 people die a day because you can't get them organs in time. 22 people die each day on average while waiting for an organ transplant. And one of the biggest problems isn't shortage. It's that organs can't stay in ice longer than a few hours without being irrevocably damaged, which was the premise for a movie that Justin helped me make back in the day.
Indeed. Yeah. No, that there was. I mean, I don't know how much we want to draw a heat to it, but I love that. That was a great idea.
Was that the puppet one?
Oh, no, this was way, way back when Justin was high school and I was recruiting, you know, high school students to work on my projects, which didn't sound as sinister then as it does now. we made an action movie about a guy trying to rush an organ for a mob boss from like Fort Lauderdale to Miami. And it was got in a film festival. It was a crappy movie, but you know, it was fun to make.
Oh, that's great.
It was great. Oh no, yeah. It's a feature length action movie wherein I play, I think, two parts. I think I'm in there. I'm in there a couple times. Couple extra roles. But you can find me as in the role of porn boy.
I forgot what that was.
Yeah. My largest credited role to date is Porn Boy in the independent action classic. I don't know. Do you want me to say the name or
it's not, nobody can find it, so it doesn't matter.
Full motion blur.
Yeah, so I think it was like some gangsters stop you at some point, grab your backpack, and then it's like you just got whack bags and tissue.
Yeah, they think that I am the guy carrying the heart, and lo and behold, I am just a random kid with a backpack full of porn.
That's amazing.
Which he showed up on set with, and he already had it, so it was great.
I mean, hey, listen, live the gimmick, baby. I'm a method actor.
Anyhow, so cryogenically warming up organs. Maybe that's getting better there, and so looking good. Random trip down nostalgia lane. Hey, I have an idea for all you all guys. I want you to do homework assignments. Uh-oh. I want you to look up like interesting family histories and stuff. You're like, okay, what's a cool sort of like family folk story or thing like that you wish you knew if was true or not?
In my family, the legend was that Brushwood was the name for a tribe called the Brushwoodsmen that were a tribe of bandits. And the legend legend was they were just like Robin Hood, except for they robbed from the rich and the poor, and they kept it.
I believe this.
I want for that to be true because that's a great story, but I don't know. So, they were ancient rogues, basically, yeah.
The murdering kind.
I'm an ancient rogue.
I'm looking up Brushwoodsman now.
My grandfather apparently was a like small time boxer of some renown. So that would probably be the big thing that I would be curious to see exactly what that was and how much that played out. Cause in my family lore, he was, you know, just this super famous old boxer.
I'm actually looking up Brush Woodsman right now because I do believe that. So what was the level of boxing that he did, Justin? Do you know?
It was regional. It was regional I guess it would be the Eastern Pennsylvania area. But apparently he had some skills with his hands. But I don't know. I kind of feel like it's probably one of those things where he trained once. He went to he got a Groupon for like one boxing training thing, and it turned into this family legend.
Did he have like a cool name? The Yelling Young?
We never got that. Which makes me think that he didn't really do it a lot. That it was just like, I don't know. It's part of, because he was an orphan. Like, he was brought up through an orphanage. And like, so it very much leads to the hard scrabble. And also it was back when people were racist to Italians. So it's like, it's just semi-immigrant tale orphanage. Like, I'll make my way with my fists, like kind of story. So it's almost
punch my way to the top.
Yeah.
I mean, my family, I have family that goes back to Indiana, into the small town where Abraham Lincoln used to live. And, there's a store that he used to work at. It's in Gentryville. And it's like my family, I have way back, I have Harters and Gentries. And, there's like, I went to the cemetery when my grandmother passed away, and it's just Harter Gentry, which Harter is my family name. And, but the story was, I had like a great, 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 great grandmother who, Abraham Lincoln worked in the family store, and he'd asked her out, and she thought he was too homely.
Oh, wow.
And then nice. There's a story about Abraham Lincoln wrote a poem about a guy who got river disease or whatever, and then went nuts or whatever. And that's like one of my family members. So that's like my family's brush with greatness. You're too ugly, then we go insane. So
that's great.
But imagine like, I don't know, like you're given an assignment hey, you're going to study. Hey, Daniel, you're going to go study World War II. Okay. And, you're living in, Denmark or whatever. And your dad's like, you should go check out, remember there's a story about a German plane that crashed on our farm.
What?
And you're 14 and you're like, German plane crashed on our farm in World War II. Like, all right. Dad, let's go get the metal detectors because we're in Denmark. What else are we going to do? And sure enough, you're going around the farm with the metal detectors. You start to get a ping, 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 ping.
No way.
And then you start to find metal shards and more pieces and more seat pieces. And then you're going through this boggy ground and you start to dig and you end up using an excavator. And the next thing you know is you're finding bigger chunks, several thousand pieces, a motor. And then you're finding bones and clothes.
Oh, wow.
It was a ME-109 Messerschmitt engine, munitions and personal items like the pilot's wallet with some money still inside and a book suspected of either being the Bible or a copy of Mein Kampf. it's easy what to are the other? The two.
Wow.
601. Jesus, that is amazing. That is I mean, and you got to figure, like, what are the ramifications of that? Like, do you now alert the family of that pilot, right? Like, and be like, oh, well, this is where they die. I mean, like, there's got to be a family in Germany that obviously under ignominious means that they never knew what happened to Grandpa.
Yeah, I would assume. I mean, they probably knew that he'd crash, but I think they never got the remains. I'm sure. Yeah, they're processing by that of repatriating remains and helping do that and, putting them final resting places and stuff. So I'm absolutely sure that the fact they found the wallet and stuff too. I mean, that's just kind of amazing that out there on the farm, this old German plane.
Well, and I guess they were pretty confident of it because like the kid, obviously it's folklore and legend by that point, but the parents probably grew up, like being able to see it.
Yeah, the grandfather had details to it, but said, "Oh, they hauled it away," or something to that effect. I guess it was sort of based upon the Klaus remembered his grandfather telling him the plane had crashed there during the war, but the plane was removed soon afterwards. And what might have happened too is that like it may have crashed, and then they went and authorities looked for munitions and stuff initially, which is what they did the second time. Is you want to make sure there's no bombs there that are just waiting for somebody to just sort of trip, cow to trip over and get blown up.
Yeah. Did you hear the story of I want to say it's a Chinese man. He had been using his walnut cracker for his entire life, and found out that it was an unfired grenade from World War II. After 25 years, Chinese man discovers his walnut cracker is actually a grenade.
Well, fired grenades make much worse walnut crackers, Brian. You get like one good walnut smash, and then it's.
But if you look at it, it's that old type, like a handle with a thing on top. So it looks like it's meant to crack walnuts. I mean, here, take a look at this.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, that looks like a pestle. I mean, that looks like it's just. Does not look like a pineapple grenade. That just looks like a walnut cracker. I have two favorite grenade stories.
as one does.
One is I had a friend whose father was in Vietnam, and he was talked about how they were hanging around the barracks or whatever like that, and everybody started to freak out and run, and he looks over and he sees that a little monkey had gotten hold of a grenade.
Oh my gosh.
And was carrying this thing around because he thought it was fruit or whatever like that, you know, and nobody wanted to take one for the team and tackle the monkey, so that was, you know, I guess the monkey eventually got bored with it, but that's, you know, nothing more hilarious than a monkey with a grenade.
And, oh yeah.
And then I had a friend, she's a costumer who worked with me on a project, and she was friends with Steve McQueen's kids.
Wow.
Right? And said that when they were kids, they were hanging out one day, and I don't know if they're in the living room or whatever, and Steve McQueen had, like, this grenade he kept on his desk, and he runs in and he goes, "Watch out!" Throws the grenade in the middle of the kids, and he dies behind a couch or whatever like that, and they all just scream and scatter.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's like, you know, I mean, I'm talking about an awesome Steve McQueen story.
Whoops.
He was just that cool.
Old.
And it was a real grenade.
For the youngins.
I think we're going to have to punt Journey Quest to next week, which is good because I think we need a little bit of a breather. And also, like, maybe we need a Logan discussion.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Logan discussion. All right. So then do we want to go?
By the way, did I already, I don't know if I already shared the text that you sent. He texted me saying, "Saw Logan, what a waste of 2 hours." And then I wrote, "You are a monster." And then he responds, ... is how I describe every 2 hour block of time I spent not watching that movie. yeah, dude, let's get spoilery.
Well, here, do we want to do picks and then, do that, or do we want to make it on after things? Like, how do we want to handle?
Oh, whatever. I always assume maybe all of our picks would have been Logan, but no, go for a pick if you have a specific pick. Please.
Sure. Yeah. No. I'll pick Logan. Yeah. So our picks are Logan. So now we begins the end of the show where we're going to talk about Logan. So if you don't want to be spoiled, then this is the point that you can tap out.
Oh yeah, and I do have a pick, a plug.
Okay, well then get the plug out now.
Okay. I've started a new podcast project, and what it is, it's kind of like it's called Magic Club. And Magic Club is sort of it's a weekly magic news show, and talk about magic news, magic business, what's going on in there. So check out, you can go to magicclub.tv, and you get the links there. And I do it with my buddy Jordan Gold, who's a fantastic magician. A lot of nice info on there. We have a second part, a companion part, which is a session where we take, let's say, a move, like a piece of, you know, some great sleight of hand bit of magic or whatever. And then we break that down in a thing. If you do the Patreon, then you can access that, where you get this session where might be just Jordan teaching me something. We had Blake Voigt was on, taught something really cool. Simon Cornell. If you want to learn magic in sort of a more kind of a leisurely sort of like sit down with some magicians as they're working on a move or teaching you some new effect or whatever like that, highly recommend Scam School. But if you want to get a little more into like just sort of like, hey, I want to learn how to do this, a one-handed top palm. Like, what is that? we'll show you. You'll get to learn that, you know, some cool color changes, some awesome rubber band stuff. So we wanted to recreate the experience of when you're with your magic buddies sitting at a table at a restaurant late at night sharing magic stuff. And, hey, let me show you this. Let me show you that. So Magic Club's the fun news, what's going on in the world part. And then the second part, the secret session, which is accessible through the Patreon. That's where you spend the time with us and we work on some move and session. So magicclub.tv.
This is a brilliant idea. I'm so excited that you guys are doing it, not only because I think you and Jordan have a great chemistry, but also the world has kind of needed a show like this, and nobody has thought, hey, let's do the podcast and then also do the instructional element. Like there is so much rad stuff that you guys can go over. And based on the fact that you're in LA and you are around all the amazing community that's between Los Angeles and Las Vegas, there's so many amazing talented magicians that you guys are regularly in contact with. If you have any interest, I would say number one, listen, and especially if you are a magician, that is a no-brainer Patreon subscription. You are going to get so much out of that.
And we want it to be very accessible. If you have an interest in it, but you're like, well, I don't really know science or stuff like that, but I'm curious, we think you'll enjoy it. And we like a lot of the stuff that we work on, I've never tried before. And so I'm like, oh, this is really cool, or this is neat. And then it's just a fun way to sort of experience that. But of course, it's funny, as you mentioned, we're local. We have all these great magicians here. Our first guest was our buddy, Simon Coronel, who was doing it for Macau. So it was great access, but we're going to Skype with the guy at the House of Magic in Macau and talk with him and that. So there you go. Magic Club. Magicclub.tv. Sign up for the YouTube channel. I think I need like 10 or 15 more people, and then I can get a channel name other than a long string of weird letters and stuff. So.
Oh, nice. All right. Yeah. So everybody go.
Yep. All right. What's next?
All right. Any plugs, Brian?
No. Let's Logan it up.
All right. Logan, spoiler begins now.
Spoiler, it's great.
Yep.
And we're done, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for listening.
I took Justin to go see it while he was in town over this last week. I'm so glad that both you guys enjoyed it. Talk me through it. What did you like about it?
There was this guy with these claws and like they were cool. I liked it because one is that just getting, like, you know, Steven Spielberg made a comment where he's like, he thought that like the superhero movie was going to fade away like the Western. And I, in all deference to Mr. Spielberg, I was thinking like, I think that if you have a very narrow idea of what a superhero movie, that is true. But I would argue that James Bond movies are superhero movies. The Fast and the Furious are superhero movies, that we've had superhero movies forever, and they've always been around. The superhero movie where it's the people in costumes teaming up to defeat the big sky beam in the middle of the city is the thing, the portal. Like, yes, that movie, about the sixth or seventh time Marvel does that movie, maybe needs to have disruption. But we're seeing, you know, this outward growth of like Guardians of the Galaxy. Hey, let's do like really cool big science fiction adventure stuff. It's a superhero movie because these guys started in Marvel Comics. But if it had been a script or a screenplay, you wouldn't have called that a superhero movie. Mm-hmm. And with Logan is, you know, the plot is very, very clear. It's a very direct clear. Get this person to safety. Get this person to safety. That's the main plot, the driver for the plot. But it's like, hey, we're watching Wolverine as he's older. You're watching this guy that his powers are starting to fade, and he becomes more interesting because he's not automatically going. He can be taken down by six or seven other people at this point, and that makes him more vulnerable. You know, the opening scene where he's wakes up in the limousine, and he realizes they're trying to steal the wheels of the car, and he's trying to save this limo because he needs it to make money to get the Sunseeker, to take the professor to safety or whatever. And he decides to use his own body to protect the car.
Because it's a lease. Because that's how down on his luck he is.
And he doesn't want to kill these guys. He's like, no, like it's just like you're stripping the nuts. Just go away. And they're like, you know, we're gonna shoot you. And you don't shoot Wolverine. That's not really good. And that was just it was a great like I could watch a Marvel Comics, you know, Marvel Netflix series about that Wolverine at that point in his life where he's working as a limo driver, you know, in LA or in Las Vegas or whatever in Texas. that alone to me is just a fascinating, this guy at this point in his life.
Yeah, so the first time I watched it, I didn't realize that – I didn't put it together until like the next day that like, oh, wait, this is just a straight-up Western. And in fact, watching it the second time, it's like they beat you over the head with that imagery. It's like, here's a locomotive. Here, we're out in the – you know, West Texas town of El Paso. Well, also, we're following the exact journey of Lonesome Dove from south of the border up to the Canadian border. And it's like, okay, I'm dumb.
Why was it? Oh, wasn't? I don't think they were trying to do Lonesome Dove. That's my opinion.
No, well, I mean, but again, just there. Once you start looking for parallels, there's lots.
Yeah, but I mean, the obvious one clearly because they watch Shane, and then when bury Wolverine, she recites the lines from Shane.
Yeah,
you know, she's repeating what she saw from Shane. You know, which was a, you know, kind of if you love the movie like Shane like I did, you're watching this going, ooh, this may. This is going to get heavy, you know?
Yeah.
Man, we talked about too, like how they did Professor Eric Brine. You pointed out like with making the Professor X, the freezing brain power thing unpleasant.
Oh yeah. Like in the theater, it was not only unpleasant for the characters on screen, the sound effect was just loud enough and just grating enough that it's like as Wolverine is going to, you know, try to stop the seizure. It's just like, yeah, make it stop, make it stop, make it stop. It was great. It was great.
So I got to see this movie within 24 hours of seeing X-Men Apocalypse on the plane flight to Austin. And it really brought up just why X-Men stories are good, how they can be done extraordinarily terrible. And, you know, to me, the most interesting kind of decision that was made is to make X-23, which, you know, is, let's be honest, in the comics is kind of, there, she's popular because she's Wolverine, but a cute girl, right? Like there's other interesting elements of the character, but as a base conceit, that's who she is. To make her the age that she is, I think was just brilliant and inspired and just gives you fresh ground emotionally to play with for all the characters involved that we already kind of know. Even, you know, Caliban is a character in both films, and in one he's this generic, crappy, like arms dealer mutant, and in another one through Stephen Merchant, he is this kind of viable element of the story that has an interaction that feels real with all the other characters. This is just, it felt refreshing, like it just felt like you remembered why X-Men stories in movies are awesome, not just so you could run through this catalog of wouldn't it be cool if this hero power matched up with this hero power, but rather like, oh, look, these are really good actors and let's give them something to chew on while we run through this story that is well done, but at the same time doesn't spare you from the most, like, you know, it's a movie that deserves credit for the emotional grounding that it gives its characters, but still has Wolverine fight a Wolverine clone, which like might be the most like gratuitous X-Men-y kind of fight that you could possibly dream up, but they make it work.
Yeah, I would argue that like if you took away the powers and it was about like an aging hitman or whatever, people will be doing Oscar talk because the Patrick Stewart performances in it were fantastic. Hugh Jackman plays, he is a very unlikable guy in this, you know, singly focused, whatever, but he is very, as Brian points out, just very classic Western, redeems himself, the anti-hero, it's not the cowboy, the white hat, it's kind of the gray hat guy that just really does not want to get involved for most of the movie, you know, just so reluctant to have to do anything.
And is constantly looking for a reason to bag on the mission, you know, like if he doesn't pass out effectively behind the wheel, he's in the process of breaking it to X-23 that like, hey, look, this isn't a thing. Like, we're just going to like not do this thing that we're talking about. And then, you know, it winds up going in the direction that it goes.
Killer performance from that little girl actress.
Daphne Keene, I think that's her name. Yeah, she was great. She was just feral, believable, really, really good. Doesn't speak for most of the film, but still conveys a lot. And just a great, and you think about, here's a girl that's got to be put in scenes with, you know, it's three people. The other two is Patrick Stewart and it's Hugh Jackman.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's right. She holds her weight. She goes toe to toe with two legends and does just fine.
She's got like that, you know, that's one of the things too, is you think about the casting, like how often kid casting just goes wrong. And she was just perfect. You know, it's like Stranger Things and other stuff. Every now and then you go like Harry Potter, you know, you're like, man, that was brilliant, brilliant casting. And you watch other movies and just how easily it could have been just to screw that up.
Oh, totally. Totally.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think that there are moments where, you know, the moment that you get the dinner, you know, is one where it's like you kind of know there's like this tension that things are going to go awry for not only our characters, but also the family. And you're like, oh, well, OK. I mean, I think this is the point in the story where we get this. But I mean, even then, it's always, it's an inspired Wolverine performance, which, I mean, Jesus, when's even the last time we had that?
Like, I didn't like the previous two Mangold films, and that he did this, he knocked this out of the park. It was amazing.
Yeah. How much of that you think is a matter of being limited by studio requirements and licensing deals? And it's like, no, you've got to do it this way. And also rating requirements where, you know, you've got to trying to hit that PG-13 mark. I don't know.
I don't have an answer to it because I think he has done some solid stuff, but I would say there were some choices made in those other Wolverine movies. I'm like, you thought that looked good? You thought that looked, you know, like we're going to go for more believable. Now here's the scene where he attacks the helicopter with the Wolverine claws. They're like,
yeah.
Okay. But yeah, it's hard to know, but here, I mean, I'm excited by the fact that, you know, last year with Deadpool being, you know, doing fantastic, Logan so far, its domestic's $152 million. It had a $97 million production budget, which is much smaller than most of these things, but it's been a far more satisfying, far more highly rated one. I am just excited about the idea of people going, you know, a superhero genre can be a lot of different things, and it can be a Western. It can be these other things. It can be these character dramas. It doesn't have to be we saved the world from the sky beam.
Right. Yeah. So isn't it kind of a bummer that this is it? Like, that's like, oh, no, wait, you just started making the Wolverine movies that we kind of like. It's like, yep, and that's it. Anyway, I mean, I'm out the door.
Does it? I wouldn't be surprised if this was not the last we saw of it. But you know, if it is, this is the best way to end.
Well, it's set in the future, too. You know, it's set in the future. Yeah. So they have a backdoor. Simon Kinberg says that he is, who's basically kind of the producer, sort of kind of overseeing the franchise and has written a number of them, including Apocalypse, but didn't write this one. He says that he has a way to sort of tie them all together in a way that makes sense. I don't
understand the obsession of having everything be consistent. The comics have always been this web of splinter timelines and alternate realities they're like Hercules stories. You know, you get enough of them that you know, you can't tie it, string them all in one narrative that makes any sense. So in that regard, I'm not terribly worried. They could just suddenly Wolverine's in space, and I'm like, all right, I'll buy it. Go.
Yeah, I think you could do like in the old man Logan stories where it starts off with the early history of Logan, you know, giving us a much better, like, you know, Logan as a kid, you know, Logan way back when he was, you know,
in the 1800s or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of like, hey, you know, that's could be a very, very cool premise to kind of explore and get into, you know, I mean, that's. And I'm fine, like, you know, cast somebody else as Hugh Jackman then. I mean, as Wolverine, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for it. You know, it was just, holy crap, watching Apocalypse. It's just like, this movie's so all over the place and so boring and so, you know, just the decisions made, you know, to put Oscar Isaac in this gigantic Barney suit for half the movie. It's an hour in before any kind of battle lines are drawn. They spend half the rest of the movie doing these like fairly pointless, like mini origin stories for everybody. It's just, you know, it especially in contrast to Logan, where it's like, no, like we wake up in this, you know, there's not a scene in the first half hour that doesn't propel us further, either in understanding the characters efficiently or down the road to where we're going with our story. And it's just, man, I don't care where it comes in the timeline. I don't care who's acting in it. I just care that it's more like the former and less, or like more like the latter and less like the former.
Yes, I concur. I know we already did our recommendations, but I have another one.
All right.
Go ahead.
Go see Kong Skull Island.
Oh, is it good?
It's fun. It's fun. I'll say like Logan, there are things of like, I go Logan, like, all right, that was really ham fisted. I thought that was just sort of a little bit too over the top with like, particularly towards the ending with the kids and stuff and trying to make sure they're going to get they're going to sponge every tear out of you. But it was so great. I'm like, I will forgive these things. Skull Island. I would say that there are, like at the opening where you're trying to get to meet like the soldiers and the people going there, it's I would say a lot of that just in sitting in a large audience, some of the kind of the jokes and stuff were just sort of like, all right, well, the people on screen think that's funny. That's fine. It doesn't ruin it for me, but I'm not as pulled into it. But as it developed, but as a solid, just fun, giant King Kong movie, I thought it was beautiful, thought it was great. I think I may have had more fun watching it than I did the Peter Jackson one. And I mean, it's Kong basically set in, you know, kind of this Vietnam era, and it's like Full Metal Kong. I was, you know, what's it like when these people just they get pulled, this army group, army helicopter unit gets pulled out of Vietnam and gets sent over to Skull Island, and they don't realize they're about to encounter a giant monkey.
Oh, that's great. We had kind of the buzz on that movie was not fantastic, and then all of a sudden it started screening and everybody dug it. So I'm pumped. I'm actually Get Out's next on the list, but certainly after that.
And they do something cool, which is like you meet Kong right off the bat. You know, like they don't hide the fact that like, I wonder what they're gonna find on the island.
Yeah.
I wonder what's there. Can you guess, audience? Can you guess? Because we're gonna make like Godzilla, we're gonna make you wait an hour to find out what's there, and you're like, we're waiting for it to show up, and once it showed up, we're kind of angry that, I mean, there's like, you meet Kong, and then it's a while before you meet him again, but like, we all know what's going on, and by the time he comes into it, there's not like kind of a, is this a footprint? What is this? It's like, yeah. The Kong introduction was awesome.
Cool.
So, just fun. Just go fun. Beautifully shot. These aerial sequences, the helicopters fighting Kong, really, really well done.
Awesome. Yeah.
Cool. Gentlemen?
Mm-hmm.
We good?
Mm-hmm. We're the best.
Would you say that it's been a fun podcast?
I'd concur.
Okay, cool. 'Cause I'd say it's been weird.
Yeah.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.